Welcome to Sojourner Truth. Thank you for staying with us. This is your host, Margaret Prescott. The Sojourner Truth team is on the road. We are in Washington, D.C., covering the Poor People's Campaign Moral Agenda Congress. The Congress runs from Monday, June 17th, 2019, to Wednesday, June 19th. The expectation for attendance was 1,000 people. And I'll have to say, looking at the multiracial crowd, they have gone over the goal of 1,000, and more are expected tomorrow. Participants hail from 41 states across the United States, from Maine to Appalachia to Mississippi to California, indeed from sea to shining sea. On Monday, June 17th, there were 6 hours of presidential candidates forum. The host of the forum was MSNBC's Joy Reid. Now, the Poor People's Campaign, for those of you who are unfamiliar with the campaign, they describe what they call in the Poor People's Campaign, the National Call for Moral Revival, the evils of racism, poverty, the war economy, environmental devastation. They also have a goal of shifting what they call the moral narrative. The joint coordinators of the Poor People's Campaign, the National Call for Moral Revival, are Bishop William Barber and the Reverend Liz Theo Harris. The Congress also launched the moral budget entitled Everybody Has a Right to Live. On Tuesday, June 18th, workshops and special training, movement training, will go on throughout the day. And on Wednesday, June 19th, there will be a congressional hearing. Now, on today's show from Washington, D.C., we bring you some of the candidates that participated in the Presidential Candidates Forum. You will hear Elizabeth Warren and Joe Biden, who showed up and answered questions from participants of the Poor People's Campaign Moral Action Congress. And they spent about 6 hours doing short presentations, but mainly answering questions from the joint coordinators of the Poor People's Campaign, Joy Reid, as well as people who are impacted by poverty, racism, environmental devastation, and the war economy. We live in a global world. We're all interrelated. So on Sojourner Truth, we work to bring directly to you news and views on local, national, and international policies and stories that affect us all. And we draw out how those of us most impacted, women, communities of color, and other communities are responding. We also discuss the interrelationship between art and politics. Now for our news headlines.
For Pacifica Radio, I'm Eileen Alfandari. President Trump is threatening to deport millions of undocumented immigrants. In a pair of tweets last night, Trump said that Immigration and Customs Enforcement would next week, quote, begin the process of removing the millions of illegal aliens who have illicitly found their way into the United States. They will be removed as fast as they come in, Trump tweeted. An administration official said the effort would focus on the more than 1 million people who've been issued final deportation orders by federal judges but remain at large in the country. It's unusual for law enforcement agencies to announce raids before they take place. Trump's announcement appears aimed at creating a buzz in advance of the formal launch of his reelection bid tonight at a campaign rally in Orlando, Florida. U.S. officials say the Pentagon is sending about 1,000 additional U.S. troops to the Middle East, part of the ratcheting up of U.S. military presence in the region. Officials say the deployment includes what they call security forces and troops for additional surveillance and intelligence gathering in the region. The troops are part of a broader military package of options that were laid out late last month, totaling as many as 10,000 forces, Patriot missile batteries, aircraft, and ships. The latest decision comes as Secretary of State Mike Pompeo and other top officials reach out to leaders in Asia and Europe to convince them that Iran was behind attacks on shipping in the Gulf. Iranian President Hassan Rouhani said his country does not want war with the United States.
American efforts in the region to cut our relations with the world and isolate Iran have all been unsuccessful. If certain companies in some countries don't want to cooperate with us because of U.S. pressure, we condemn America for this. We don't want war with any nation. Those facing us are a group of politicians with little experience.
Senator Bernie Sanders said in a statement on Friday that attacks on oil tankers in the Gulf of Oman are unacceptable and must be fully investigated, but he said the incident must not be used as a pretext for a war with Iran, which Sanders said would be an unmitigated disaster for the U.S., Iran, the region, and the world. Sanders said he was also reminding President Trump there is no congressional authorization for war with Iran. Russia's UN ambassador protested the U.S. escalating what he called aggressive, accusatory rhetoric, saying the U.S. was artificially fueling anti-Iranian sentiment. Egypt's first and only democratically elected president, Mohamed Morsi, was buried under heavy security early this morning. Morsi's son said security agencies refused to allow Morsi to be buried at the family cemetery in his hometown in Sharqiya province, and instead had him buried at a Cairo cemetery dedicated to prominent Islamists. Morsi collapsed and died inside a Cairo courtroom. He had been in prison since being overthrown in a military coup 6 years ago. The Muslim Brotherhood, which Morsi once led, accused the government of assassinating him through years of poor prison conditions. The group demanded an international investigation into Morsi's death and called on Egyptians to protest outside Egyptian embassies across the world. Hong Kong's embattled leader apologized for an unpopular extradition bill that drew massive protests of up to 2 million people. Carrie Lam indicated it will not be revived during the current legislative session.
People have expressed in a peaceful and rational manner their concerns about the Fugitive Offenders Ordinance and their dissatisfaction and disappointment with the government, especially me. For this, I offer my most sincere apology to all people of Hong Kong.
But Lam did not formally retract the legislation, which would allow some suspects to face trial in mainland Chinese courts. She also said she hoped to finish her term, shrugging off calls for her resignation with repeated requests for another chance. Police used tear gas, steel batons, and rubber-coated steel bullets against protesters during scuffles outside government headquarters last week. Hong Kong pro-democracy lawmakers like Claudia Mo said they weren't satisfied with Lam's public apology. Mo said the public has no trust or confidence in her.
She acknowledged herself that it's all a question of trust and confidence in her administration, which have become completely non-existent.
Separately, Joshua Wong, the student leader of the 2014 protest, demanded that Lam step down. He said she had created a governance crisis and called her apology fake. In Berlin, Germany, city leaders are proposing a 5-year rent freeze in response to dramatically skyrocketing rents and a shortage of affordable housing. Rents have nearly doubled in Berlin in the past 8 years. I'm Eileen Alfandari. You're listening to Sojourner Truth on Pacifica Radio.
Those were our news headlines. And we now go to the Sojourner Truth coverage of the Presidential Candidates Forum at the Poor People's Campaign Moral Action Congress, taking place over several days in Washington, D.C. Joe Biden was the first speaker. Let us go to hear his opening statement and the question and answers that followed.
I'm honored to be here today in the Poor People's Campaign, and that's just what it is. Reverend Barber, you and I have talked about this before, but the fact of the matter is what you're doing really make a difference. You are, in fact, picking up where it was left off by Dr. King, when, in fact, he decided that it was necessary to go beyond just poverty among African Americans, but across the nation. Because for too many years, the animating principle of what's happened is that with great income inequality, what's happened is the charlatans have been able to pit black folks against white folks, against Latino, et cetera. And because if you have a problem, it's the other. Look what's happening now. The reason why the poor folks are poor is because of all those immigrants, all those Muslims, all those African Americans, et cetera. It's a bunch of malarkey And the fact of the matter is that the People Campaign intends to end this exploitation. And the exploitation is more extreme than it's ever been because of the gigantic income inequality that exists here in America. It's greater than any time since the turn of the last century. Reverend, it's not only that we have less than half the people in the United, almost half the people in the United States living in poverty. It's ridiculous that we have this extreme change that's going on. Deep inequities in our society. Our policy discriminates against and devalues black people, Native Americans, people of color, women, LGBTQ individuals, people with disabilities. I'm going quick because I have 4 minutes. Refugees, immigrants, asylum seekers. And look, they talk about our children. These aren't somebody else's children. They're all our children. They're all our children. They're the kite strings that literally lift our national ambitions aloft. So you can't say it's their children. They're America's children. And we have an obligation. And every single one of them should be treated with dignity. You know, today is the 4th anniversary of the massacre of Mother Emanuel Church down in Charleston. And the fact of the matter is that Reverend Pinckney was a friend, and he was murdered along with 8 others parishioners. But it was ultimately a show of hate, the clearest example of the poisonous ideology of white supremacy. But here's the point. When we went down there after to celebrate the loss of those people and their lives, President Obama stood there and he ended his presentation with Amazing Grace. And it's amazing the impact it had. I got to stay afterwards the next day. My family and I went to the regular service. And I listened to I met every one of those family members. And they forgave. They had the grace to forgive those who did the horrible things that were done. And they put enormous pressure.
That is your time, sir.
Thank you very much.
Thank you very much.
Great being with you.
All right. So come sit on down. No, come back. Sit on down. All right, Bishop Barber, if you have a question.
Amazing when a preacher has a problem with a microphone.
I'll tell you what.
let me ask this question. The Poor People's Campaign is building a movement to root out the interlocking injustices of systemic racism, poverty, ecological devastation, militarism, and the war economy, and what we call the distorted moral narrative of religious nationalism. Vice President Biden, I'm from the South, the Sun Belt, where 1/3 of all the poor people live in America. That's 50 million people. 13 million of them are uninsured. And the southern states, along with some other states, 26 of them to be exact, have the worst records on voter suppression and racialized gerrymandering. But here's the other side. The persons who get elected by what some courts have now called surgical racism, once in office, they vote to deny health care, living wages, cut public education, deny women's rights, immigrants' rights, LGBTQ rights in ways that hurt, in raw numbers, more low-wealth white people. There are 26 million poor low-wealth blacks and 66 million poor low-wealth whites in this country. Here's the question. When will you go and spend significant time in the South and the Sun Belt to put a spotlight on these issues? How will you fight to win a new electorate of poor whites, blacks, Latinos, natives, rather than write off the South and the Sun Belt? And lastly, how will your campaign and administration address the issues of poverty, low wealth, health care, low wages in a way that undermines the myth that these issues impact small, marginalized groups of people only rather than all of us?
First of all, I plan on campaigning in the South. I plan, and if I'm your nominee, winning Georgia, North Carolina, South Carolina, believe it or not. And I believe we can win Texas and Florida if you look at the polling data now. Doesn't mean it's a marathon. It's a long way off. If you may recall, Reverend, I'm the only person who went in and campaigned in the off-year election for the senator in Alabama. I was the only person invited down there to speak, not the only, but I was the only one who wasn't a person of color that was invited down. I spent a lot of time campaigning in North Carolina and Texas and around the country. I have no intention of walking away if I'm the nominee, and if I'm not nominee, I have no intention of walking away and trying to help whoever the nominee is to win those states, number one. Number two, as President of the United States, were I to be elected, I would make sure a number of things happen. Number one, we have to bring back the, you know, what happened with the Voting Rights Act, as you well know, when there was a decision, the Shelby County case occurred, and it said that it's going to eliminate the requirement of you have to get pre-clearance to change anything dealing with your voting rights legislation, that anything that changes. The truth of the matter is, I thought we had made real progress. I was chairman of the Judiciary Committee, or the ranking member, when we extended the Voting Rights Act the last time for 25 years. It was five-year increment. I was there and did it for 25 years. And at the time that happened, we had a unanimous vote, 98-0. All those Southern boys and women voted for it. They went, I thought, maybe there's progress. Maybe things are beginning to change. But what I vastly underestimated was how deep and systemic the racism is and why, in fact, it never gives up. It's like cutting grass. You got to do it every week. You let it go for a month or 6 months or a year, you got a forest in the middle of your yard. And so I would do my best to get a United States Senate, the Democratic Senate again, and reinsert the Voting Rights Act and overrule the Shelby case as a practical matter. That would change things dramatically. With regard to everything from education to the prison system, I think everyone's entitled to have total health care. And what I would do is make sure that every single person, as I propose, every single person in the United States has access to Medicaid right off the bat. I would triple the number of the amount of money we spend on Title I for underprivileged schools, from $15 to $45 billion a year. And I would make sure that we had preschool for three and four or five-year-olds in every single state in the union. I would make sure that we're in a situation where we had more social workers and more school psychiatrists, et cetera, going into those schools, because guess what happens? It's a long question. It's an essay, okay? You're looking at me like I'm going to stop. You want me to answer anymore or want me to stop? Okay. She's the moderator. Well, anyway, let me conclude by saying, look, folks, there isn't a single reason in the world why every single solitary child in America is not covered by health insurance. There isn't a single reason in the world why any parent having to pay for daycare should, in fact, not have a $8,000 tax credit. I was a single parent for 5 years after my wife and daughter were killed and my sons were badly injured. And I had a lot of help. And I had the salary of a senator then at $42,000. And I found it hard. I can only imagine what it is for single parents trying to raise a child on a minimum wage. We have to raise the minimum wage to a minimum of $15 an hour. It's disgraceful that someone works 40 hours a week and lives in poverty. There's a whole lot of other things I can speak to, but the bottom line is, I think your budget, my dad had an expression. He'd say, someone come to my dad and say, let me tell you what I value, Joe. He said, don't tell me what you value. Show me your budget. I will tell you what you value. These guys don't value education. They don't value the poor. They don't value any of the things we're talking about right now.
Let's have Reverend Theo Harris ask a question.
Great. So the Poor People's Campaign has done an audit, and we found that there's 140 million people who are poor or one couple hundred dollar emergency from deep poverty. We want to know, even though there's so many folks, 43.5% of the population, the media doesn't cover it. Most politicians don't talk about it. People prefer to talk about the middle class. And then when we're told is that there's not enough to go around, even though they can find 53 cents of every discretionary dollar for the military. So we have a three-part question. One, what are you going to say about this lie of scarcity? Two, how are we going to immediately and fully, not incrementally, eliminate poverty? And three, what can you say about your view on military spending and the militarization and the problem of warmongering that's happening in this country and world?
Number one, we have the greatest income inequity in the history of the United States of America since 1902. And the fact of the matter is, there is plenty of money to go around. The first thing I would do as president was eliminate the president's tax cut, which added to the deficit $2 trillion. And also, we now have $1.6 $100 billion in tax expenditures. Fancy word for saying loopholes. You cannot justify over $1 trillion of that. And so we have the money. And what we should do for it, I'll give you an example. It's not just, we're not talking about the middle class. We talk about the poor because they have to have access to be able to get into a place where, in fact, they can live a decent life. Everyone's entitled to be treated with dignity. And you have no dignity when you cannot provide health care for your children. You have no dignity when you turn around and look at a talented child and realize there's nothing you can do to help them get an education. You have no dignity. So my point is that as a United States senator, and then more importantly, 8 years as vice president, we moved to cut the budget, if you'll recall. I'm the guy the president put in charge of ending our presence in Iraq with we had over 160,000 troops overseas. We took over and the president said to me, what are we going to do? We moved them down. We're now down to one-fifth of that amount of people involved. We should not be involved in a war in Yemen. We should not be surprised. So there's so many things that we can do in terms of the military budget. But also, folks, remember, there is $1.6 trillion in loopholes. Give you one example. We could make sure every single solitary person in the United States qualified to go to a community college if we have a good education system for preschool through 12. We could put them all of them free in a community college or qualified for $6 billion a year. There goes that big spending Democrat, right? Well, guess what? Eliminate one loophole. It's called stepped up basis, because I was listening to the poorest man in Congress for 30 some years. I didn't even know what it was. Stepped up basis means you have a capital gain. You go out and buy $1 million worth of stock and you end up selling it for $2 million. You got to pay a capital gain. But God forbid you get hit by a truck on the way to sell it. It gets left to your daughter or son. They pay no tax. That means $17 billion less collected every year. You could put every single solitary child qualified community college, cutting in half the cost of college, giving them opportunities that go well beyond anything that exists now, and I can do it and still have $11 billion left over. It's one little tiny illustration of the ability we have to do so much. The idea we cannot triple money for Title I. The idea we cannot provide an $8,000 tax credit for any man, woman who is, in fact, needs it for child care, et cetera. So this is all within our wheelhouse, and we don't have to punish anybody. This isn't about punishment. You take away $500 billion of these loopholes, you're not going to affect any wealthy person's standard of living, for God's sake. They're not going to have to sell their second or fifth or 15th home, whatever the devil it is. This is just plain fairness, simple, basic fairness, and we have all the money we need to do it.
All right, Mr. Vice President, I'm going to bring up Francine Jefferson. Where is Francine? All right, Francine, ask your question.
Good afternoon, Vice President Biden. Thank you for taking this question. My name is Francine Jefferson. I'm here with Pastor Finch, who's from rural Indiana. In fact, he lives on the banks of the Ohio River, which is the most contaminated river in the country. I and some of my family members and friends are here from Mississippi, from the floodlands of the Mississippi Delta, where Dr. King first launched the Poor People's Campaign 51 years ago. So I'm coming from a place called Chula, Mississippi, Holmes County, which is the poorest county in the nation. Recently, we had a flood that destroyed homes and fields, left the crops devastated, and we've seen almost no governmental help. Now, it's not uncommon for us to be ignored. Again, we've held the title of the poorest county in the nation for a long time. But the truth be told, we're living in the richest nation in the world, and we are the poorest county. There are a lot of places like this all over the nation, and we're experiencing real national emergency. My question, Mr. Biden, is, well, first of all, to say to you that poverty hurts. High poverty in the United States is the wrong thing. It's morally corrupt, but it is fixable. And my question is this: how will your administration respond to the increased threats of national disasters, emergencies from climate change, and the connection to the ever-present emergency of poverty across this country?
In the interest of time, I've laid out in detail a global warming initiative, but focusing first and foremost on what we do with those communities that are the poorest communities that are hit the worst by environmental degradation. Whether it is flooding, whether it's being in the shadow of a smokestack, whether it's lead paint in the wall, whether or not it's You can't turn on a faucet without drinking poison water. That would be the first and foremost focus immediately what happens as we move towards zero emission. Number one. Number one. Number two, the whole idea that, in fact, we think that the global warming that's occurring and having this phenomenal impact on the United States of America and the world is a consequence of it hurts everyone equally. It does long run, but in the near term, it's a gigantic unfairness to people in poverty because they live in the wake of all of these things that are happening. And so, folks, the additional piece of this is that there is no reason why it's not, by the way, it's overwhelming the interest of everybody. If we end this gigantic division, bring people of poverty out of poverty, move them into a place where, in fact, they are able to compete, they get a fair shot, whether it's housing, whether it's education, whether it's healthcare, whatever it is, it benefits the whole nation. And we got to stop letting these guys use the divisions that exist in the country as a means, like charlatans always do, to divide the country. Well, the reason why that black man doesn't have a job in your county is because of that white immigrant coming across the border here, or that Hispanic, or that Muslim, or whatever. It's used by charlatans all the time. And we have a guy in the White House who's turned it into an art form. It has to end. It has to end. The division has to end, and we have to start talking about what we're going to do explicitly for each of these people. The environment's the first thing. Lastly, I agree with Jim Clyburn. He has a 10-20-30 program where he says that any county that, in fact, has been in poverty for 10 or more years should be the first place where any program that affects counties, the money should go first in that order. We should start with the poorest and work our way to the wealthiest counties. And so I think that program would be instituted fully with me as President of the United States. I think it would be instituted fully with me as President of the United States.
And may I ask you, Mr. Vice President, just in follow-up, really to all of three of these questions, because what you've talked about are initiatives that would eventually have to wind up in the Senate. And you were in the Senate for quite a long time. You've experienced Mitch McConnell up close. He comes from a state that has substantial poverty, a southern state where you would think these kinds of programs would be both needed and popular, whether on the environment or whether on economics. He's dead set against them all. How would you get past either a majority Republican Senate in which Mitch McConnell was determined to kill all of these ideas, or even a Mitch McConnell in the minority who repeated the consistent filibustering that happened when you were vice president, and anything that came from the Obama-Biden administration, Mitch McConnell considered dead on arrival?
Joy, I know you're one of the ones that think it's naive to think we have to work together. The fact of the matter is, if we can't get a consensus, nothing happens except the abuse of power by the executive. Zero. Number one. Number two, there are certain things where it just takes a brass knuckle fight. There's no way to do it. And what you do is when they say we're not going to support you, we do what I did last time. I went into 68 races in 22 states, and they were not blue states. They were not blue areas. And guess what? Remember, I got criticized by a lot of you in the press saying we're going to win back the House. We went over 40 votes. Well, we got 40 votes back, and we beat people who were, in fact, Republicans with mainstream Democratic people going in and saying, look, this is what they're doing to health care. This is what they're doing to, you have to go out and beat these folks if they don't agree with you by making your case. And that's what presidents are supposed to do. Persuade the public. Move people as to what's going on. Last point I'll make. Remember with the Affordable Care Act. Because everything landed on President Obama's desk but locust at the time, he had no time to explain the Affordable Care Act. Once it got started taken away, all of a sudden, we have what we call in Southern Delaware, we had an altar call from all those boys. An altar call saying, oh my God, I'm for health care. I don't want to take away pre-existing conditions. I want to make sure, et cetera. And so you go out and you beat them. You make the case. You make an explicit case, just like we did for the House. I think we can do the same thing for the Senate. Secondly, you got to make it clear to Republicans that you understand on some things there is a rationale for compromise. For example, when we did the Recovery Act, which the President, as you may remember, the State of the Union say, Joe will do the Recovery Act, $89 billion. And it was done without any waste or fraud, 2% waste, fraud, or abuse. What happened there? We didn't have the votes initially. So I went on and I changed three Republican votes. But you try to persuade. Doesn't mean you can do it all the time, but it kept us from going into a depression. And so, folks, look, if you start off with the notion there's nothing you can do, well, why don't you all go home then, man? Or let's start a real physical revolution if you're talking about it. Because we have to be able to change what we're doing within our system. Because you talk about the creed. We the people. We the people. We hold these truths self-evident. We haven't always lived up to that standard. But we've never fully abandoned it. And the moment we abandon it, we lose everything we stand for nationally and internationally in terms of the power of our persuasion. The reason why the rest of the world follows us and we're secure is not because we have the largest military in the world. It's because we not only lead by the power, the example of our power, but the power of our example. And you can shame people to do things the right way.
Bishop Barber has a question.
Yes, we prepare to end this section. One of the challenges that the Poor People's Campaign is bringing to everybody is that there's nobody that's not at blame. Republicans are at fault for the conditions of the poor. Democrats. We have virtually eliminated the conversation about poverty and policies and the interlocking injustices. We keep wanting, for instance, most of the time when there's a conversation about racism, it wants to talk about cultural racism, not policy racism. And then there's not a connection to that and poverty and so forth and ecological devastation. So here's the question. In 2016, we had 26 presidential debates on the main stage, televised. Not one of them focused an hour on addressing the problems of 43.5% of this nation, 140 million poor and low-wealth people. I didn't have this question at first, but as you continue to talk, and I think I'll ask it to everybody, will your campaign advocate for a complete debate on the issue of poverty in the United States of America?
Yes. And Reverend, that's why I'm here. That's why I'm here today. The notion of dealing with poverty in America is not only systemic, it is incredibly debilitating. It's the one thing that can bring this country down. And it gets worse and worse and worse. And if you take a look, my whole career, I've talked about poverty. That's what I got involved with. That's why I got started in the first place. It was about the injustice that exists, not only in my state, as you know, you're one of the few people, has the eighth largest African-American population in the country. But it was also a state in the southern part of the state where they're talking the great accent, and we couldn't make up our mind exactly which side they wanted to be in the Civil War. But there are a lot of poor folks down there. Those poor folks, what they call hanging chickens in the chicken industry, which is a multi-billion dollar industry. And most of them are Caucasian. And so the point is, we got to make it clear to people that they're all in this together, but we don't do that very well. But my son Bo and I, before he died, he was the Attorney General, we're the only two Caucasian guys that won downstate, as they say, and won overwhelmingly in the black community, because I don't make a difference. I don't trim it. And you've been with me, you know that I don't trim it. And that's what it is, what it is. Let people know the truth. The American people, if they're exposed to the truth, and you go out and knock on their doors, you sit with them in their living rooms, you walk into the diners and make the case, they get it. They get it. And look, part of my dad had an expression, half of winning is showing up, Rev. Just showing up. That's why I'm so proud of you. I'm presumptuous of me to say this. Well, I'm so proud of you. Look what you, no, I, all of this, but that's, you started this. You organized this. You put this together.
We have just a little bit over a minute left. Can I ask, President Obama largely spoke those kinds of messages and was so compelling. Why do you suppose the other side did not hear it?
Well, look, they did hear, here's what happened. Let's be honest with one another. When the President of the United States, my friend Barack Obama, was elected, it was the greatest honor in my life to serve with him and become a close friend. Here's the deal, though. The world was falling apart. The first year, he did everything just to keep us from going off a cliff, completely off a cliff. Done, finished, depression. And it took enormous amount of credit, enormous amount of capability for him to do it. Then he moved in and he made sure that we did something no other president has ever to do, the Affordable Care Act. And we did it without a single Republican vote. And in the process, it was hammer and tong fighting. At the same time, he went on and tried to change our foreign policy and end our involvement in these wars. And he did it. And by and large, until things changed around and we made so many mistakes subsequently. So the point was, President Obama talked about these things, but the first thing first was, it didn't matter a whole lot, guess what, if in fact we were in absolute depression in the United States of America.
We're going to take a short station break, and when we return, we will hear from Senator Elizabeth Warren and her participation in the Poor People's Campaign, Moral Action Congress, Presidential Forum. Stay with us. We'll be right back.
Whoa, somebody's hurting my brother, and it's gone on. And we won't be silent anymore. Did you know somebody's hurting my sister, and it's gone on? Yes, it's gone on. I tell you, it's gone on. Oh, somebody's hurting my sister, and it's gone on. And we won't be silent anymore.
Welcome back to Sojourner Truth. And that music is from the Poor People's Campaign. And the Sojourner Truth team is on the road. We are in Washington, D.C., covering the Poor People's Campaign Moral Action Congress. And on the first day of the Congress, there was a lengthy presidential candidates forum. We're now going to go to hear from Elizabeth Warren, her initial presentation, her opening, as well as the questions and answers that followed.
I want to start by telling a little story. It was a little over a year ago. I've been working with Poor People's Campaign for a long time. And it was a little over a year ago that I got a call from Reverend Barber. And he said, we want to come to Washington. And he said, we want to bring the Poor People's Campaign to Washington. Some of you are nodding because some of you came. And we want to talk to Congress. We want to witness to Congress. We want to tell Congress what it's like to be poor. And we want to tell Congress what they can do about poverty. And so I said, what can I do to help? And he said, call a hearing. I said, you bet. So I called Elijah Cummings from over in the House. Many of you know Congressman Cummings. Good man. And the two of us put on a hearing, and we invited everybody in Congress, every senator, every congressperson. Now, some of you will be surprised to hear only Democrats came. But they came. Folks came to listen. But here was the key part, the people who came to testify, the people who came to witness. And they told their stories, one after another, about what it means to be poor, about what it means in terms of your life, your children's lives, your dignity, your opportunity, how you see the world. And it could have been a sad hearing, could have been a depressing hearing, but it wasn't. And I'll tell you why. It's because of the people who said, and I remember the woman who said it first. She told a story of real heartbreak, and then she said, and here's how I see it, here's why I'm in this fight. Don't waste my pain. Yeah. And here she is in the front row. Don't waste my pain. And that's how I see this moment in Washington, this moment in our country. We have a fundamental issue, and that is, who is our government going to work for? Is it going to just keep working for the rich and the powerful, keep working for a thinner and thinner slice at the top? Or are we going to have a government that works for everyone else? Well, I want a government that works for everyone else, and that's what this fight is all about. So I'm in this one all the way. You know, right now, the rich and the powerful, man, they want to see tax breaks in Washington. They get them in a matter of weeks. They want a hearing on their issues. They get them in a matter of weeks. But for us, it's not going to happen that way. It's not going to happen because we don't own the lobbyists and the lawyers to make it all happen. It's got to happen starting at the grassroots. It's got to happen with people who make their voices heard. It's got to happen with people who start with the fundamental idea that I know what this feels like. I know the change we need to make in this country. Don't waste my pain. We're going to build a better America, and we're going to do it together. So that's why I'm here today. Okay. All right. Thank you.
Thank you very much. Here is the chair is yours. Bishop Barber, you want to start?
Thank you so much, Senator, for being
here.
Thank you. So we've got this reality. First of all, getting the numbers right. You know, for years we heard 37 million people in poverty, so on. So the reality is 140 million people, 43.5% of this country. The reality is 26 million black people, but that represents almost 60% of black people in concentrated poverty. But then there's 66 million white people, poor and low wealth. So in terms of raw numbers, it's more white. We've got systemic racism and just in voter suppression. I won't go through the other ones. It's in voter suppression that we haven't seen since the days of Jim Crow. 26 states before this current president, 26 states since 2010 passed racist voter suppression laws. 4 million people that get up every morning can buy unleaded gas, can't buy unleaded water. A military industrial complex that has just gone berserk and that Eisenhower, Republican, warned us about, King warned us about. Where we're spending now 53 plus cents, a very discretionary dollar, on military, mostly contracts for war, and less than 16 cents of every dollar on healthcare infrastructure. Then we got this false moral religious narrative that somehow says if you're, you know, if you're for tax cuts and for guns and for against women's rights and against gay people and against immigrants, that somehow that's the moral godly thing to do. This is formist, right? We're this form. But in 2016, there were 26 presidential debates, 140 million people in poverty, not one debate on poverty and the interlocking injustices connected, not one full debate on voter suppression and racist gerrymandering. Will you push and use the power of your campaign to push and ensure that of the televised debates, there will be a debate that focuses on systemic racism, how that's connected to systemic poverty, ecological devastation, the war economy, the false moral narrative, religious nationalism? How will you do that? And do you even believe that it is necessary for us to have that conversation in front of all of America, not just some of America, as you see here today?
Yes, I do. I think that is the conversation we need to have with all of America. And there's so many ways that this is intertwined. Can I just start with one piece of this? And it's where you went, Reverend Barber, and that is where we spend our money. You know, you start to talk about budgets, and there are a lot of people who just kind of glaze over. And they say, oh, that's math. I don't have to do that. That's just numbers. You know, we'll let the experts work on that. We don't really have to worry about that. The truth is, no. Tell me how you spend your money, and I'll tell you what your values are. Because that's where it shows up. And that's why one of the keystones, central parts of what I talk about now in my campaign is that we start in America with a wealth tax. We need to put a tax on the top 0.1%, the biggest fortunes in this country. And here's the idea behind it. It's a 2-cent tax. It says once you've got $50 million, your first $50 million fine. But I know you've relaxed over that now, right? But when you hit that 50 millionth and first dollar, you got to pitch in 2 cents. And 2 cents for every dollar after that. It's a tax on wealth. It's a tax on the great fortunes in this country. And understand this. It's not a tax to say there's something bad or you've done something bad. It's to say you built a great fortune in this country. You had some great idea. You worked really hard, or you inherited well, whichever way. But the point is, if that fortune was built here in America, I guarantee it was built at least in part using workers all of us help pay to educate. It was built at least in part getting your goods to market on roads and bridges, all of us help pay the bill. It was protected by firefighters, all of us help pay the salaries for. So we're just saying, you make it really big in this country. Pitch in 2 cents so everybody else has a chance to make it in this country. And here's what that does. 2 cents from the top 0.1%. And here's what we can do with it. We can start out by providing universal child care for every baby in this country age 0 to 5. We can provide universal pre-K for every 3-year-old and 4-year-old in this country. We can raise the wages of every child care worker and preschool teacher to the professional levels that they deserve and that we want our children to be taken care of, people who have real professions here. We can make public technical school, 2-year college, and 4-year college tuition free for every one of our kids. We can put $50 billion into historically black colleges and universities so that they can play from a level playing field in building tomorrow's leaders. And we can cancel student loan debt for 95% of the people who have student loan debt. We can do all of that, and we can hit the opioid crisis head on. We can put $100 billion over the next 10 years to putting the resources right down into the communities that are on the front lines in this fight. We can actually save lives, save families, save communities across this country, and we would still have money left over. What I want you to understand about every part of this, and I know you understand this, is asking those at the very top to put in 2 cents is enough to be able to help all of our children build a future. Not just some of our children, but all of our children.
Let me follow up on that question, though, because I really want to get at it. One of the things this campaign is saying, though, that if we don't say the word poverty, and if we do not have a debate that focuses on poverty and systemic racism and ecological devastation as combined, not as silo issues. And one of the things we've been really asking the candidates is, do you believe we need to have that debate? Because in 26, last time, we didn't.
Yes.
We didn't have, and will people push and go to the media and those setting up the next 26 or 30 debates and say, listen, there's no way in the world we can have this happen again. 50 some years after the voting rights decision, we have less voting rights today than we had 50 some years ago, more poverty, and 43% of this nation in poverty, and we're having a political discourse that won't even say the word poverty in the mainstream, right? And that's what we want. That's the question. Will we push to have that debate publicly with all the media there? Yes. Okay.
Yes. Right. Joy
has a question.
Oh, I had a quick follow-up, because you're in the United States Senate, obviously, and it's an interesting place with an interesting leader.
That's a nice way to put it. Very diplomatic.
Yes, uh-huh. Try to be diplomatic. Uh-huh. How would you, as president, enact this policy, the idea, which is, you know, it polls very well, the idea of doing a wealth tax, but it would run into two gauntlets. One would be Mitch McConnell, whether he is the majority leader or even as minority leader with the power of the filibuster. And number two, the people whom you might not be so popular with, the very wealthy, the Wall Street, the payday lenders, the people who are actually now sort of doing very well policy-wise that would fight this tooth and nail. How would you enact it?
Okay, so let's start at a technical level, because you asked the question that way. Let's be clear. If we're in the majority and Mitch McConnell wants to block us on the kinds of things our country needs and the kinds of things they elected me and other people to enact, then I'm all for getting rid of the filibuster. We cannot let him block things the way he did during the Obama administration. I've been there when it was one set of rules when President Obama was president, and now it's a different set of rules now that they've got Trump in the White House. We can't do that as Democrats. We have to be willing to get in this fight. So that's part one. But part two is to understand this is about making democracy work. So the way I see this, when you ask the question, and you rightly say, by the way, that wealth tax, it's not only popular among Democrats, it's not only popular among independents. a majority of Republicans support it. Same thing for getting rid of student loan debt. A majority of Republicans are there. This is something we can build support on all across this country. But what it really means is that we got to be building our grassroots movement now. This is what the Poor People's Campaign is all about. You've been doing this for a long time. But it's build it not just toward November of 2020, which I'm all in favor of, but it's keep that momentum up so that come January of 2021, we are fighting for real change. A president who leads and a people who say this is what we want. That's how we get pressure on Congress and get to make the changes we need to make in this country.
All right, let's bring up Beth Jones. Where is Beth? Beth is in the audience and has a question for the senator. All right.
Hi, Senator. Thank you for coming. I'm standing with Swami Dayananda. She is a Hindu monk from Yogaville Community Serving with Union Hill Baptist Church and Friends of Buckingham for Environmental and Climate Justice in Virginia. I come from Southeast Louisiana, where we have one of the fastest eroding coastlines in the world. And not far inland, some of the poorest communities, you'll find a long line of petrochemical companies. Families have been flooded with deadly poisons for generations. There's toxins in the air and the water that has caused so much illness that some folks call our corner of the country Cancer Alley. Ecological devastation and the climate crisis is happening all around us. And the poor and marginalized are always the first to be hit. What is your plan to ensure that everyone has a right to clean water, air, land, and to defend our environment?
All right. Thank you. Thank you for the question. Can we start by saying that environmental issues are poor people's issues? Because it's critical to stop and acknowledge that. You know, I've been working on different parts of environmental plans. And the very first one I did was about what a president can do, and I love saying this, what a president can do all by herself. The kinds of things that don't have to go through Congress. So for example, the first day that I'm sworn in, I will put in place a moratorium that on all of our federal lands, on all of our national parks, there'll be no new drilling, no new mining for petrochemicals, and offshore, no more. We're not going to do that. When I rolled that out, the very first place I went was to coastal South Carolina, where poor people, where working people, where people in struggling communities are on the front lines, trying to stop offshore drilling. They make their lives and their livelihoods from that water. And they say, just, you know, all it's going to take is one spill, one accident, one mistake, and it'll wipe them out for generations to come. That indeed, the very fact of doing it, the waste produced by this and the changes, they don't want to see it. And the hardest part is their voice doesn't get heard. Not in a world that is full of, let's listen to the lobbyists. Let's listen to the people who can make the big campaign contributions. Let's listen to the folks who can hire bought and paid for experts. You know, when you've got a government that works for a thin slice at the top, a government that works for those who can show up with plenty of money and doesn't work for anyone else, that is corruption, pure and simple, and we need to call it out for what it is. So I'll tell you this. I'll make this promise. And that is, I am in this fight so that this government doesn't just work for those at the top. Here's the good news. I've got the biggest anti-corruption plan since Watergate. Here's the bad news. We need the biggest anti-corruption plan since Watergate. But no one needs it more than the poor. than the people whose voices don't get heard, than the people whose communities get destroyed. No one needs it more than the people whose livelihood is taken away, whose clean air is taken away, whose water is destroyed and undrinkable. And that's the fight we have to be in. We have to be in that fight morally, we have to be in that fight economically, and we have to be in that fight politically every single day. Count me in on that one.
Reverend Theo Harris.
So in 1968, when the Poor People's Campaign was launched by Dr. King and other leaders, they were talking about the tripartite evils, the connection between systemic racism and poverty and militarism, and how every war, every bomb dropped in Vietnam, and now we have a lot more wars, was a bomb in unservices to the poor of this country. We spend 53 cents of every discretionary dollar on the military and 15 cents on education, healthcare, and anti-poverty programs. So what are you going to do to end this war economy, to challenge militarism, and to lift the load of poverty?
So we need to cut our military budget. Now, this is, and there are multiple ways we should be thinking about this. We need a military and a Department of Defense that constantly isn't just saying, our plan is more, more, more. How much more can we absorb? How much more can we get? No, we need to think of our budget in terms of our values. One way we can deal with that budget is we need to stop the endless wars. No great nation fights endless wars. We bring our people home, that is billions of dollars that we have to spend here at home on our people, on our future. Every time we make an expenditure, I go back to this question about budgets. Every time we decide we're spending money on this instead of that, we're making a very concrete statement about our values. And for me, this is not about how to help a giant industry. This is not about how to make a department bigger and bigger and bigger. This is not about how to support endless wars. This is about how we build an America that is strong, that is vibrant, and that works not just for those at the top, but works for everyone.
We are out of time, and I'd really like to thank the Sojourner Truth team, our fearless assistant producer who really stood all day long on his feet videotaping and recording this for you, the Sojourner Truth audience. I'd also like to thank the engineer, Mr. T. Teddy Robinson, and all who helped to make this show possible. If you'd like a copy of today's show, please contact the Pacifica Radio Archives at 1-800-735-0230 or go online to pacificaradioarchives.org. Sojourner Truth will be back on the air tomorrow with more coverage from Washington, D.C., of the Poor People's Campaign Moral Congress. Thank you for listening. This is your host, Margaret Prescott.